Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Philadelphia, was an amateur boxer, nightclub singer, and pianist. He became a writer and has been voted the number one sports columnist in the nation 13 times by the Associated Press. He was a panelist on ESPN's Sports Reporters for 26 years and is the author of 13 books, including Tuesdays with Maury, and his latest book, Twice, which will be released next week. He's written three plays and hosts a daily radio talk show here on WJR since 1996. His name, Mitch Albom. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Jack Rasula, and we're with Mitch Albom. Mitch, welcome back, and honored to have you.
Jack, always a pleasure to talk to you.
You're a fantastic storyteller. How'd you get so good at telling stories?
Well, thank you for that, and I appreciate that. If I am good at it, I got good at the dinner table, to be honest with you. I grew up in a family of, one of those large ethnic families that had big get-togethers at the holidays, and I would listen to my older relatives tell stories at the table. I was the kid who would sit around after dinner when all the other kids ran away so they could play, and I would listen to my uncles and aunts, some of them from the old country, telling stories. And I remember, Jack, my aunts invariably got caught up with details. They would say things like, so it was 46. Was it 45, 40? When was Tony born? Was it 45 or 40? And my uncles would start yelling, tell the story already. And then the uncles would tell the war stories. And they'd say, so there we were. We were on the hill, see? And we were coming over the hill. And we couldn't see. We weren't sure where the enemy was. And the skies were lighting up. And the bombs were dropping. And I said, well, that's how you tell a story. And I really learned from them, the pace, the cadence, the what you leave in, what you leave out. And for whatever reason, I've always been pretty good at telling the story.
Why are people so moved and inspired by stories?
Well, it's the oldest form of communication, isn't it? I mean, we have stories on cave walls. Before we even really knew how to write, we were telling stories. I think there's something about the way the brain is wired that you can tell somebody, be good, or it's better to share, or don't be greedy, or you can tell them a story about a dog with a piece of meat in his mouth who crosses a bridge and looks in the water and sees his reflection and wants the piece of meat in the other dog's mouth and barks and drops the meat that he has and therefore loses what he has, and everybody goes, oh, okay, I get that. So it's somehow stories bring to life the things that we're trying, the points that we're trying to get across, more so than a lecture. And I think that's why people embrace them.
You joined the Free Press, hard to believe, 40 years ago, 1985. How did that come to be?
Mike Downey was working for the Free Press and got offered a job in Los Angeles and took it. He was a young columnist who was very popular in town because, I think, of his youthful approach and his humor and kind of creativity in his column. And so the Free Press was looking to replace him with somebody who did similar kind of work. And at the same time, the Detroit News, which was very competitive back then, if you remember, there's real newspaper wars going on back then in the mid-80s. They saw this as an opening for a chance to grab some of that audience that Mike Downey had developed. So they went out to look for a young guy. And both of them landed on me. And I got a call from each of the papers within 24 hours. One from the Free Press, one from the News, saying they wanted to interview me. I ended up flying up to Detroit. I told each one of them, well, the other paper called, we don't care, we want you. So I ended up flying up to Detroit on the Free Press's dime, staying down at what was then the Marriott, I think, is now, it's now the GM headquarters, but the hotel down on the water. Stayed that night on their bill, went and did an interview, then checked out of the hotel, checked back in under the Detroit News' account, went and did an interview with the Detroit News, spent the night on the Detroit News, flew back home on the Detroit News' ticket to try to keep everything fair. And a day or so later, I got offered a job at both places for the exact same money, which makes me wonder, Jack. Somebody was talking to somebody. I don't know. It's some very strange to me to this day. But I called Mike Downey and I said, listen, I got offered both of these jobs. I don't really know anything about Detroit. Where do you think I should go? And he said, you should go to the Free Press. They'll let you be creative the way you like to be. And that's, I took his advice and, you know, no knock on the news. It would have been a good place to work too, but I'm happy that I did what I did.
Speaking of being creative, we're talking to Mitch Albom. He's the number one sports columnist in the nation, 13 times by the Associated Press. Okay, let's go to 1996, 29 years, Mitch, and you walk into WJR. How'd that come to be?
Well, so I didn't just walk into WJR. I don't want people to think that that's how you get a job at WJR. You just kind of walk in and they go, okay, here, come on upstairs. I was working at WLLZ doing a morning sports spot on the rock and roll station, WLLZ, with JJ and the morning crew and then later Ken Calvert. And JP McCarthy, you know, we were friends and I'd done his show many times. And I had come and done, I guess, Focus or one of his shows. And he said, what are you doing over at that rock and roll station? You should be at WJR. And I said, well, okay, you know. And he said, yeah, you should come over here and come over here. And he kept kind of, you know, working it. And finally, when my contract was up with WLLZ, WJR came and offered me a show. And I had already been doing a Sunday night show on WJR, so I was somewhat familiar with it. And I decided, okay, but I don't really want to do sports. And they said, no, we don't really want you to do sports. We want you to do, you know, just sort of general American life and, you know, Detroit life and things like that. And that interested me because I've always been interested in things more than sports. And so for a very short period of time, J.P. McCarthy and I were employed by the same station. But actually, I agreed to come on in like the middle of 1995. But couldn't start until 1996, and by that point he had passed away. And so we actually never got to work together, but he was really the guy who was responsible for it.
We're talking to Mitch Albom. When we come back, we're going to ask him about his first day of class, Brandeis University, 1975. He walks into a class, and there's 9 kids. Change the world. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Mitch Albom. He's written 13 books, 3 plays. Books have sold 42 million copies. Mitch, you walk into a class, 9 kids. You count them. You say, I can't skip class if there's only 9 kids. And you start walking out the door. What happened?
Well, the class was an introduction to sociology class with a teacher named Maury Schwartz. I had signed up for it before I got there because it was my first day of school, so I hadn't met him before. And when I walked into the room, there were 9 kids in the class, and I thought, oh, no, you know, this is one of those classes where if I cut it, they'll know I'm not here. You know, I wanted to learn in those big lecture halls. So I actually turned to walk down the hallway to go drop the class. You know, you could go to the registrar's office and drop the class. And Maury began to call roll. And one of the problems when your last name begins with A is you're not going to get out very quickly. And I heard him say, Mitchell Albom. And I could have kept walking because he didn't know it was me. And I promise you, if I had kept walking, Jack, you and I probably wouldn't be speaking. And I certainly wouldn't be known for any of the things that I'm known for now. But because I felt kind of guilty, I sort of went in to the classroom and said, here, you know. And he said, well, is it Mitch or Mitchell? Which do you prefer? And I was kind of touched by that because most people don't ask me that question as a teacher. Yeah, I can be Mitch or Mitchie or Mitchell. So I said, well, Mitch, my friends call me Mitch. And he said, Mitch it is. And Mitch, and I said, yeah. He said, I hope one day you'll think of me as your friend. So I knew cutting the class was out of the question at that point. And that began that amazing relationship that I had with Maury Schwartz that started with that class and went on for 4 years at college. And then 16 years later, when he fell ill with the Lou Gehrig's disease, and I began to visit him again and do another class with him, which turned into the book Tuesdays with Maury, which turned into something I never expected, which turned into an entire career, which I never expected. So everything kind of goes back to that moment and not dropping the class.
I believe that you were channel surfing one night in a hotel, you saw Ted Koppel interviewing the coach, Maury. You call him the next day. He says, come visit me. That was 19 straight weeks. And then he dies. And you decide to write the memoir. There had to be like 100 publishers dying to publish the book for you, Mitch?
No. No, not even close. Maury was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease. That's why he was interviewed on Ted Koppel's show about what it was like to die. And when I saw him, I was horrified because I hadn't stayed in touch with him. I had been very ambitious in those 16 years, and I was mostly just concerned about my work and my advancement. And so I felt guilty. I went out to see him once turned to twice to three times, turned out to every Tuesday that was left in his life. About halfway through, I discovered that while we were doing this last class together, the thing he feared the most was that he would leave debt to his family. And they'd have to sell the house and everything else because he was racking up all these medical debts from ALS. And so I got the idea that maybe I could write a book to help him pay his medical bills. And I didn't tell him that I was looking for publishers because I didn't want to fail. I went around to every publisher in New York, Jack, and virtually every one of them said, no way, not interested, boring, you're a sports writer, it's depressing, nobody's going to read it. And I would have given up, really, if it was just for me. But because it was for someone else, I kept pushing and pushing. And finally, about 3 weeks before Maury died, I found a publisher who was willing to give us just enough money to pay Maury's bills, which I gave to him. And at least that was, for me, that was kind of the end of Tuesdays with Maury, because I had learned to do one kind thing for this man who had done so many kind things for me, you know. And I never thought anything would come of that book. Maury never read a word of it. I didn't start writing it until after he passed away. And it wasn't supposed to be a big book. And all those publishers who said it was going to be boring, that they were going to be right, except they weren't. And something else happened.
Well, I think the first printing was 20,000 copies. Today, yep. Friends, 25 million copies, and it's been translated into 48 languages. It's the best-selling memoir of all time, Tall Cotton. Okay, Mitch, next week, you have your newest novel comes out, titled Twice. All right? Two main characters, Elfie and Gianna Rule. And at 8 years old, Elfie discovers that he has magical powers. Mitch Albom, what are these magical powers?
Well, it's one power, and he has the power to do everything in his life twice. So if he wants, he can go back and change the outcome of any one event. The stipulation is that he has to live with the second try. So if the second try is worse than the first, too bad. He also has to live from that moment forward again. So he ends up repeating a lot of his life. Every time he goes and fixes a mistake, he has to go forward from there. So he goes through his life, you know, fixing his embarrassments and fixing, you know, when he misses a shot in a basketball game, he goes back and knows where the pass is going to go and he intercepts it and then he makes a layup instead. And, you know, the embarrassments that he has as a teenager, he fixes all those. And then when he becomes a man and he falls in love, he finds that there's one caveat to the power that he didn't know about. It doesn't work with love. So, in fact, it works the opposite. So if you have someone who loves you, and you decide, well, okay, you know, they're great, but I want to see maybe there's somebody else out there, and you kind of go back to try somebody else, that first person can never love you again. You forfeited that love forever. And he finds the woman he thinks is the woman of his dreams, and they get married, and then something happens, and he gets tempted, and he has to make this very critical decision. And I won't tell you any more that what happens next, except it's a book about the grass always being greener on the other side.
You allowed me to read a galley copy ahead of time. It comes out next week. It's ingenious. It's like a 1,000-piece puzzle. Did you plot twice in advance, timeline C's, or did you evolve as you wrote it?
A little bit of both. When you write a story about time travel, you have to be very careful that, you know, you follow your own rules. And because people read those things very carefully and it can get confusing. So I try to keep it simple. He gets to do things twice. That's it. He can't send himself back in time to the Titanic. You know, he can't jump ahead to the future. He can just, if something happened to him, he can go back and fix it one time. So if he messed up on a spelling test, he could go back and take the test again and get an A on it. If he fell off his bicycle, he can go back and avoid the pothole. But he can't change other people's lives. He can't keep somebody from dying if they're going to die. You know, he doesn't have that kind of power. And so the trick of it, Jack, is just to make sure it makes sense within that world. And hopefully I did an okay job at that. But
you did
we'll
an ingenious job. People that have read it said, this is your book, best book ever. Okay, which scene or moment in Twice was the hardest to write and why?
Oh, well, that's easy. Alfie discovers his power when he's 8 years old, when his mother dies. They're living in Africa. His parents are missionaries, and she gets bitten by a bug. She falls ill, and he goes in to sit with her on his father's instruction, but she's sleeping, and he's a kid, and he doesn't want to just sit there watching her sleep, so he goes out and plays. And when he comes back, she's died. And his father is angry with him. He says, I told you to sit with her. What happened? And he's so furious at himself, and why did I do that? And that sort of brings on this power. And he wakes up the next morning, and it's the day before. And his father says, go sit with your mother. You know, and he's like, how can I sit with my mom? He says, just go sit with your mother. He doesn't understand what's going on. And he goes to the bedroom, and there she is again. And that moment of a boy getting a chance to see his mother again when he knows that she's going to die was very poignant to me because, you know, my mother passed away. And, of course, I would love to have that moment again. You know, I would have the moment to say things that I didn't get a chance to say. And so that moment is when he realizes he has this power. But then he also realizes he can't change her fate, and she still dies, you know, but she gets to talk to him and tells him about his power. And that was a very emotional scene for me to write, and hopefully it came across that way.
We're talking to Mitch Albom. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about the new book Twice, and I'm going to ask him the $64,000 question. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Pasula. We're with Mitch Albom, whose newest book, Twice, comes out next week. Here's the question, Mitch. What inspired you to write this book?
And that's the $64,000 question. If I answer correctly, do I get $64,000?
The check will be in the mail, Mitch.
Okay, good. What inspired me to write the book? I think getting older. You know, when you're young, Jack, and you want to try something different, you just go and do it. But when you get older and you think about doing something different, it starts to become a regret. It's like, I should have done this, or it's too late now, but I should have gone into that business, or it's too late now, but maybe I should have married this other person, or it's too late now, but maybe I should have moved to this place. We do a lot of that sort of, if I had it to do over again, I would do it differently. And I realized that if I'm thinking about those things, then other people must be too. And so I said, let me write a book about getting someone who actually gets a chance to do everything over again and finds out that it's not all that it's cracked up to be. And there's a moment in the book where Alfie, the character who has the power, is talking to his grandmother, who also has the same power that he does, he finds out. And he starts peppering her with questions. How come we only get two tries? How can we only get two tries? How can we only get two tries? Why can't we do more? And she turns to him and she says, Alfie, if you kept getting second chances, you wouldn't learn a damn thing. And that is kind of the essence of the book, that we all think that, oh, we get to do it over again, or we do it this or differently, but we don't realize that the lessons that we learn from our mistakes are the things that make us better people and are the things that form our personalities. And if we never made any of these mistakes, we wouldn't be who we are. And so when people ask me, is there anything you would do differently? I say, of course there is. There's a million things I'd do differently. But if you said to me, okay, you get to do them again, but you lose whatever wisdom you gained from making that mistake, you lose the lesson that you learned, then I would say, no, I don't want to do them again, because all of those lessons have helped form who I am today.
Mitch, what role did your wife Janine play in the writing of this book?
So I wanted to write a book that sort of demonstrated my love for her, despite various challenges. And in the book, Alfie, the main character, finds this woman, the perfect woman for him, really when he's 8 years old. He meets her in Africa when his parents are missionaries and they're playing with an elephant. And she comes back into his life later on, and he kind of realizes she's the perfect person for him, but he's flawed and he makes a lot of mistakes. And at one point he makes a really big mistake. And so I just thought it was a way of sort of apologizing to Janine for, you know, any shortcomings I've had, and trying to express my love to, for her as in a book.
All right. Let's different subject. Let's go back to late January 2006. Detroit's getting ready to host the Super Bowl. And you decide to spend a night as a homeless person. And you're in a shelter, I believe. You're in a line. And somebody taps you on the back of your shoulder. Who was
that
and what happened, Mitch?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't decide to spend the night as a homeless person. What I was trying to do was, it was the Super Bowl, and there was a story about a Super Bowl party for the homeless, and I didn't understand what that was. When I looked into it, it was really a euphemism for getting all the homeless people off the street and kind of keeping them away from bothering the customers, and then on Monday morning, they were going to put them right back out in the cold, which I thought was really cruel. And so I decided that I would go down to a homeless shelter and spend a night there just to write a story about what it was like, not for me, but about what it was like for everybody else and how you couldn't give that to people and then take it away from them just because it was convenient for you. You know, you don't help people just because it's convenient for you. You help them because it's the right thing to do. So while I was online at the homeless shelter, I had gotten my blanket and my bar of soap and all that stuff, and I was waiting online for the meal. And as you mentioned, this guy in front of me turned around and he looked me up and down and he said, "Aren't you Mitch Albom?" And I said, "Yeah." And then he looked me up and down again and he said, "So what happened to you?" And, you know, I kind of chuckled a little bit, and then I realized he wasn't joking, that in his mind, you know, why wouldn't I have just fallen upon hard times, perhaps, and you know, suddenly found myself homeless? And I never forgot that, because I thought, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. And he had every right to assume that. I'm sure he never figured he was going to be online at a homeless shelter. So I went back and I wrote a column and I mentioned that story in it. And I, you know, tried to urge people to give us enough money to keep those homeless people in the shelter, not till Monday morning after the Super Bowl, but till April, when at least the weather would warm up. And I was trying to raise $60,000, Jack. And after about a week, I had $320,000 just from people sending in, you know, $10 and $25 and $50 saying, you know, we want to help. And with that money, I started something called Say Detroit, Super All Year Detroit. That's what it stands for. And that little investment has now grown to a multi-million dollar organization that operates 9 different charitable operations throughout the city, everything from rec centers to a bicycle factory to dessert shops to shelters and daycare centers and senior citizens and new homes for people who have been homeless and things like that. So from very unusual circumstances can wonderful things happen.
God works in strange ways. All right. Through you and Rosie, I met a man named Daryl Woods a few years ago. Unbelievable human being. Tell us about Daryl Woods, please.
Yeah, he's been a blessing in our life, too. Daryl came to our attention after he was released from prison after 29 years for something he didn't do. And finally, his sentence was, you know, turned over, and he was allowed out. And I had met him and read about him, that he wasn't bitter, that instead he was trying to help make life better for other people, which is astounding to me, because I think if I had been falsely in prison for 29 years, helping the government or the city or the system in any way would be the last thing on my mind. But Daryl's a very unusual guy. And we asked him if he would help implement a program that I came up with, because it was in the aftermath of George Floyd. And as you remember, cities were really divided between police and citizens. and everybody was very distrustful of their police departments. And so I had the idea that maybe we could get police and citizens together in a non-confrontive fashion. And having grown up in a you know, family that always communicated well over the dinner table, I thought about food, and I thought about, well, maybe we could get police and you know, like gang members, ex-cons, members of the community, to kind of come together and eat food. And maybe the way to do it would be they don't know that they're doing it with a police officer or with a gang member. And so we organized this big barbecue where we invited cops and, you know, formerly incarcerated people, gang members, members of the community, to come and grill this in this big barbecue. And everybody just wore their regular clothes. And Daryl was kind of the organizer of it. And everybody cooked together, had to cook the food together. And it was really fun. It was out in the street. It was a nice day. And we're cooking up all the barbecue. And it's fun to cook on a big grill. We had these big things that we were loaned by a wonderful organization here in town. And so after they finished eating, Daryl stood up and said, well, let's get to know one another a little bit. And he started walking around, and he introduced kind of the regular folks. And some people would say, well, I just got out of prison, or, you know, I've had some hard times, or this, that. And then he went over to the police officers, and he said, well, what's your name? And, you know, let's say the guy's name was Joe. He said, well, I'm Joe. And what do you do? I work for the city. Oh, really? What do you do? I'm a cop. And when he announced that he was a cop, like three or four of the people at the table popped up and started to run. And Daryl said, whoa, everybody just stay where you are. These are the same people who you've just been eating with and laughing with and having fun with. Now, let's realize that we're all human beings first. And by the end of that 2-hour session, everyone was exchanging phone numbers, and many of the regular folks were saying it was the first time they'd ever had contact with a police officer. Police officers gave them their cell phone numbers. They said, hey, if you ever see cops doing bad things, call us. We want to know about it. And this template has become such a success that we have done it countless times. I can't even tell you how many, dozens and dozens.
Over 100 times, Mitch.
Yeah, over 100 times around the city. And we've done it in schools, and we've done it with kids, and it just works so well. And Daryl is the linchpin of all of it. He's so believable because he's been on both sides. And that's why he's such a blessing to us.
Better Together is the name of that initiative. We're talking to Mitch Albom. When we come back, we're going to ask him about another ministry he's had since 2010. I'm Jack Rasulin. This is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
You've been listening to your inspirational fireside chat, Anything Is Possible, for nearly 20 years.
This is Anything Is Possible, and I'm Jack Crisullo.
But what has Jack been up to lately? Search at AIP Speaker Series and find out. Jack has interviewed thousands of historical voices, some of whom have offered him their philosophy of life, like Tom Izzo.
And Tom writes, work hard, persistence always wins out, discipline is the highest form of love. Stay humble.
The great Ernie Harwell.
My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God.
And the voices of our generation.
I am reassured continuously that His unfathomable love and mercy are the greatest gifts of my life and my constant source of strength, reassurance, and guidance. His Holiness, Pope Francis.
At AIP Speakers Series is the YouTube channel where all of these jewels can be heard, including some of Anything Is Possible's greatest guests.
And we're with Mitch Albom.
The Little Liar is really a book about truth and lies and the price we pay when we lie.
This is Anything Is Possible, and with Tom Watson.
My father loved to play with the pros at the club. Developed a very quick friendship with Stan and played some golf with him. And then he would ask me to play golf with him and Stan.
Our guest this week was born with a rare disorder characterized by the absence of arms and legs. His name, Nick Vujicic.
Something that every human being actually deals with, Jack. It's the choice of continuing to believe or giving up.
And recordings of the AIP Speaker Series events at St. John's Resort. Go to YouTube and search at AIP Speaker Series. It's free. And remember,
anything is possible.
Spohom. I'm Jack Crisullo. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Mitch Albom, whose new book, Twice, is being released next week. Mitch, let's go back. January 12th, 2010, the earthquake in Haiti. Please.
Well, the earthquake in Haiti was devastating. It killed 3% of Haiti's population in 45 seconds, close to 300,000 people dead, and it left 10% of the country homeless. I went down with the pastor to an orphanage who he thought had been destroyed. It hadn't been destroyed, but it was overrun. It was very, very poor. I was so taken with the kids there and their attitude, their faith, their joy. I began to bring back plumbers, roofers, and contractors. We had about 23 people. They called themselves the Detroit Muscle Crew, and we built the first toilets the place had ever had, showers, first kitchen. We built a school. Eventually, the pastor left, and I just kind of inherited the orphanage later that year, and I've been running it ever since. I go there pretty much every month. The recent violence has kind of interfered with that a little bit, but for 16 years, I've basically been there monthly. And we built it up into a beautiful place where kids who from the most impoverished backgrounds, many of them are abandoned. One was left under a tree to die. Other ones were left at malnutrition centers. Some have no birth certificates, no names. They come to us with illnesses, starvation, malnourished. But they come to a place of love and faith and education and medical care. And they live there with us, and we raise them. We get them to go to school, a really great school that we have built on our campus. And so far, every one of the kids that has come through our school has graduated and has gotten a college scholarship. So we have 18 kids now here in Michigan in college, one that's in his third year of medical school and another one that's going to medical school. And we just brought up five more who started as freshmen in schools like Hillsdale and Calvin and Madonna and Hope and Lawrence Tech. And they're just doing phenomenally. Unfortunately, Haiti is a terrible, terrible mess right now. Hugely violent, very dangerous. Gangs control almost all of Port-au-Prince, and they're gaining control of the rest of the country. We have to take bulletproof cars wherever we go. We have to have bodyguards. It's really a mess, and very, very dangerous and very difficult. But our kids continue to thrive, and we try to keep it going with contributions, and whatever contributions don't cover, I pay for myself. And those kids are the pride of my and my wife's life. And many of them live with us or live right next door, and they're here all the time. They're all coming in this weekend because periodically they all come home from college, and we have about 22 kids at the dinner table, and it's lovely and wonderful, and it's a joy to behold how lives can be affected just by, you know, the slightest bit of food and water and education and love.
All right. There was a little girl born on January 9th, 2010. Her mom died while giving birth, to a baby boy. And this little girl, Chica, is dropped off at the orphanage in spring of 2013. She was an angel to you and Janine. She was a teacher. Tell us about Chica.
Yeah, Chica, as you said, came to us when she was very young. She was the loudest kid we'd ever had. And in some ways, the most obnoxious kid we ever had. 3 and 4 years old, you could hear her from across the yard telling everybody what they could do, where they could go. But she was funny and lovable. And when she was 5 years old, she developed a brain tumor. And we brought her here thinking that the doctors would be able to get rid of it and she'd go back. But unfortunately, it turned out to be something called DIPG, which is a four-letter word for death. And she ended up just never going home. And we essentially adopted her and traveled around the world trying to find a cure for this terrible disease. And although they told us she would only live 4 months, she lived 2 years. And we had an incredible 2 years with her where she affected our lives greatly. And while we didn't find a cure, we did find a family. And she brought great love and great inspiration and great faith to everybody she touched, even in her brief 7 years here on Earth. And I wrote a book about it called Finding Chica. Because one time she asked Janine and I, how did you guys find me? Because, you know, she didn't remember her life really before she got to the orphanage. And so for her, like, she thought we came through the forest somehow and found her. And so I called it Finding Chica, and she still means the world to us.
What's the biggest thing that little girl taught you and Janine?
That family comes in all forms. That DNA has nothing to do with it. Blood has nothing to do with it. If there's love and there's compassion and there's caring and there's a desire to sacrifice for your child, you have a family. And they don't need to look like you, and they don't need to speak the same language, and they don't need to come from your biology for you to have everything that a family needs, which is love and togetherness and faith.
Speaking of family, I think you were in high school, and God sent you an angel by the name of Mark Rosenthal, a.k.a. Rosie. He's been an angel in your life, Mitch.
Well, I'm not sure I would use that description, Jack, but he has been a great friend and a great partner. And it's true, we met when I was about 5 years old. He was my sister's age. She was 2 years older. But we formed a band together when I was a teenager, and we played together in that band, and we were tight buddies ever since. But many years passed, and I happened to go back one year, and he was a very successful band leader in New Jersey and doing events and things like that, but he was kind of looking to try something else, and I was in need of a radio producer, and we were going on the air with MSNBC, so I kind of needed a radio TV producer, and I don't know how we started talking about it, but somehow I thought he might be good, and then my wife Janine said, he would be great, you should hire him, and so I said, well, do you want to come to Detroit? And he started commuting from Philadelphia to Detroit. That was, I don't know, about 1999 or somewhere around there, and been with me ever since. So I'm very blessed to, you know, you talk about twice and second chances. You know, I have this great second chance to have, you know, one of my childhood buddies be now my adult buddy, you know, as well as my partner in everything, you know, from Say Detroit to radio to my book tour. You know, Rosie will be going with me, and he manages all the stuff, and We have a great relationship that exists mostly on laughter and teasing. And I'm gonna tell him that you said he was an angel, because I'm gonna remind him he needs to behave that way.
He's the wind beneath your wings, Mitch.
Well, he's the wind, all right.
All right.
I don't know if it's always beneath my wings.
Thanks a million for doing this.
You're welcome.
Thanks for writing this book twice. Thanks for all you do, Mitch Albom.
You're pleasure, an angel, Jack.
Thousands and thousands of people.
It's a pleasure, Jack. Always great to talk to you. God bless.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohome.